So before I really get into the meat of the talk, I have to tell you a story. It's a true story. Sometime last spring or earlier on, Carrie contacted me about sharing with you guys some thoughts in this setting. And I was very excited about that opportunity. And I duly prayed diligently about what topic to think about and came up with an idea that I thought seemed pretty exciting and got to work gathering citations and filling up my Concord program with them. And, you know, a month went by and I was really not feeling it, as they might say. It just wasn't coming together in a way that was exciting. And I had been talking to different nurses and a couple other administrators, like, about what people needed to hear about and what would be a healing thought. And yet this topic that I know might be useful on some other occasion, just didn't come together for me at all. And so, I just sat quietly and prayed, and this idea of the sacred work that fills our life with song just came to me in a very quick and sudden way. And immediately ideas started just flooding in. So I knew that that was the real thing you guys were supposed to hear about. Thank goodness. So beginning of July, I think, Carrie said, so what would you like to call the talk? So I had sent her this idea for the title. And then later in July, I went off to work at Cedars as a practitioner in Pal House, which is their main camp part of the camp. For those of you who have not had a camp experience, it's extremely, when you're there to work, it's extremely engulfing, and it's wonderful, and I love it. And we have some camp counselors here who know all about this, but I can't think about anything else. All I can do is focus on Cedars and on what I'm there for, and there's lots of good work to do, and it's completely engrossing. Well, I came across Matthew. And I don't know whether this was during family camp or during before that. I have to be honest with you. I'm not sure. I think it was like the second week I was there. And I had known Matthew from a couple years previously. We'd done some singing and stuff together at camp during family camp. And he had mentioned that he had done this singing with another practitioner who gave a talk at a different facility about a year ago. And I thought, oh, that would be awesome. And I'm doing it in Sacramento, where you live. You could just do this with me similarly. And he says, so what's the title of your talk? And my jaw hit the floor. I could not remember. Couldn't remember. I'm sitting there at Cedars. I'm just completely engrossed in Cedars. I could not think of the title. And I said, well, here's what I'm talking about. I could tell him what I was covering, but I couldn't remember the title. So I went, but I really think what you're doing would fit in. Ha ha. So I go, that night I got on my computer and I honest to goodness had to look it up and find the letter I sent to Carrie to see what the title was. And the sacred activity that fills our life with song. I couldn't wait. I wanted to go find Matthew like at 11 o'clock at night and say, look at what the title is. You've got to do this. So I'm sorry to get into this story first, but I am so grateful, and it's so wonderful to have Matthew here as part of this experience, and you're very fortunate to have him in the Sacramento area. I hope that you all draw mightily on his gifts, and I know you'll enjoy hearing him throughout. We have a few hymns we're doing together, but most of them include all of you, so you can look forward to singing. So what we're talking about today, the joy of sacred work, is sometimes difficult to put in words. And that's because it's not technically visible, is it? That kind of joy. We can see it in smiles and things like that, but deep, abiding, sacred joy is something that would be hard to say that you can see. It's a real feeling, and we want that feeling in our everyday work. Mary Baker Eddy talks about a parable that Jesus shared about the the leaven, the measure of the leaven that she, that this woman took and put in three measures of meal. And she speaks of that. She says of that parable, did not this parable point a moral with a prophecy, foretelling the second appearing in the flesh of the Christ truth, hidden in sacred secrecy from the visible world? So what we really want to do is see this invisible in a visible way around us. And that's not so far off of what we're what we find in the Bible lesson and what the Bible tells us about hidden things becoming visible. But it's this ability that we all have within us to recognize God or love or life in all that we do, whether we're eating a sandwich or conversing with a grocery clerk or nursing at Olive Glen. If we can move towards being aware of this sacred nature, we can tap into what you might call this infinite water table below, like Jesus spoke of with the Samaritan woman by the well when he told her that she could have this water of life infinitely. And I love that in this week's Bible lesson we have this passage, from Isaiah. Behold, God is my salvation. Therefore, with joy shall ye draw water out of the wells of salvation. In becoming conscious of the presence of God and the sacredness of love's presence, life's presence, we can get a sense of that sacred thing and increasingly find it visible. I do this most often through nature, really. I have a bird feeder outside my office, and it just fills me with joy to see these creatures. And it just, to me, reflects that sense of animation and life and beauty. Paul understood this when he wrote to the church in Rome, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. So today, what I hope we will all go home with is a little clearer sense of how the sacred can intersect with the everyday in such a way as to find ourselves feeling a kind of joy that's spoken of in that hymn that fills our daily lives with song. What do you love to do? What do you look forward to doing? What makes you smile and laugh and feel at peace, satisfied, and joyful? Hopefully, whatever it is that makes you joyful, it's something that you do every day. Our lives should be filled with song, no matter what your voice. But if our work or daily life is something that we are dreading or even just putting up with, then we're definitely needing to make some progress and some changes. Do we need a new job or a new career or a new marriage? I'm saying probably not any of those things. Certainly none of those things are prerequisite. What is requisite is consciousness, and that's a spiritual consciousness, an awareness, an awakeness to the presence of good. The power and love and joy of soul. This really will bring about a revolution in our experience of day-to-day joy and satisfaction. This is something that I've been taking note of in recent years, this idea of consciousness. When how truly conscious, you can ask yourself this at any given time, how truly conscious am I right now? When we're taking inventory of the present moment, being aware of God's presence in that moment, we tend not to get to the end of the day and have that empty feeling of just being tired without having actually experienced a genuinely satisfying work. Being genuinely conscious of any activity gives such activity the potential to be deeply satisfying. And really, we mostly tend to live on the subconscious level. Day to day, it's surprising how often we're really just functioning subconsciously. So as an example, you might think, when's the last time you consciously thought about something like brushing your teeth? Another kind of silly example is flossing, if you do that. As soon as I try to think about the fact that I'm flossing, if I haven't already started and I start in the wrong place, I realize that I can't, it's really hard for me to get to the right all the way around because I lose track of where I am. Because apparently this is an activity I do not think very deeply about, and I start in one spot and move around. It's a silly example, but there's so much that we could bring to our life because being conscious is being prayerful, isn't it? That's what it is. So if we were, for example, to be conscious when we eat, how much more would we appreciate what we eat? How much less might we eat? How much more care would we take with gratitude and thoughtfulness as we chew? I know it's something I need to do more consciously. And then how much more satisfied would we feel if we are conscious of what we eat? So that's just a silly example, but it's a way of approaching daily life with more consciousness. Even our conversations, we're often barely listening to each other, more like we're waiting until it's our turn to tell our story, or we perfunctorily say things like, have a good day. What if you genuinely looked a clerk in the eye and meant this, and it wasn't artificial, but meant that statement of have a good day? It would be an act of consciousness that would bring you joy, but certainly, almost certainly, would bring them joy as well. We can tell when somebody is really seeing us or not. And in the sacred work of nursing, I would say that that consciousness is paramount and essential. One important element of this kind of sacred consciousness is some level of stillness, a willingness to step back from the busyness, from our cell phones perhaps, from trying to get as much done as possible in the fastest possible way. We can still have an important career. We can still have too many children. We can still have lots of appointments. But it is a lie that we don't have time to be still. We can look at the example of Elijah in 1 Kings. He stood up in that cave and watched as the wind tore mountains and broke rocks in pieces. That must have been quite a display. But the Lord was not in the wind, the Bible tells us. And then he watched and felt, I'm sure, the earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And finally, the fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. I was reading some Bible commentaries about this story, and several of them claimed that we don't really know that God was in that still, small voice, and which seemed absolutely ridiculous to me as I read it, but I wanted to sort of see why what might make somebody say that. And the thing that answered my question is the next part of the story, and it says, and it was so when Elijah heard it, that still small voice, right, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entering in of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him and said, what doest thou here, Elijah? Well, the fact that he wrapped his face in the mantle indicates to me that he was thinking in terms of not wanting to see the face of God, which people biblically felt that they would not survive. And Moses was our only known prior to that person who had been able to see God face to face. And as you recall, it made his face shine in such a way that people were really uncomfortable, and he had to wear a veil whenever he was done talking to God and talked to the children of Israel. He had to put something over his face so they didn't all freak out. So to me, that indicates he did indeed hear the voice of God, and of course we know that. But what was Elijah doing there? What was he doing? Was he thinking and praying? I kind of don't think so. I think he was full of despair, not stillness. And I think that's why he had that opportunity. He had swirling, riotous thoughts of despair and fear. And he felt alone. Even after that great proof that he'd previously had with the servants of Baal, when he had God set that huge sacrifice on fire in front of them. And this is instructional to me in that this is what we get from an unwillingness to be mentally still and conscious. And if we don't have our goal, as Elijah did, of true worship of God in whatever we do, we run the risk of staying in that earthquake and wind and fire and never hearing the still small voice, which is indeed speaking to us, but speaking to us in stillness. Spiritual consciousness is the awareness of God around us at all times. You're going to hear me say that a lot. It is like spiritual sense, which Mrs. Eddy says in Science and Health, is the discernment of spiritual good, something we can all do. If stillness is one element of sacred spiritual consciousness, then another really helpful element is the recognition that there is only now. Whenever we're feeling anxious, regretful, resentful, or angry, we are thinking of future or past, not present. When you think about it, is there really anything but the present? There are many well-known thinkers who've addressed this idea of only having now, but I find it most thrilling to read that Mary Baker Eddy recognized these ideas of nowness nearly 130 years ago. In her autobiography, Retrospection and Introspection, she writes, "The human history needs to be revised and the material record expunged." This doesn't give us license to bury the past or not to learn from it. Rather, it gives us the opportunity to remove a separate sense of self, a sense of self that could never have been. For example, could never have been a victim or an abuser. At the center of that example is always an I that feels separate from God. And of course, there's less aggressive examples than, you know, a victim or an abuser. Even things like anxiety put us firmly in the center of a struggle for a sense of control or for a lack of control. And again, if you think about it, anxiety is always something that is dealing with the idea that there is a past or a future, right? We aren't expunging or revising facts, but lies. When healing results, we know that we've been truly overcoming mistaken concepts of time. You can imagine how much joy this process has the potential to bring, truly bringing to fruition. As it says in Joel, "I will restore to you the years that the locust hath eaten." Time is how we measure repetition. It is, obviously, a human concept, so that we can make it to appointments and catch trains and buses. It's also necessary in that regard, right? We might call that calendar time. But Mary Baker Eddy has little to say about time that would make us want to give our consciousness, our spiritual sense, over to the suggestion of time. In other words, to be conscious, we must be aware only of now. Isn't that an interesting thought? Being conscious or aware of God means only being in the present. This does not negate gratitude or remembering. Rather, think of it as those are now our expression of gratefulness, is a feeling that we have now for people or things that may have occurred, but it's our present sense of that. At least that's how I explain it. One place where Mary Baker Eddy uses the word time in a kind of positive way, but only because it's how God measures it, and in fact it disappears in this definition, so I don't know if you really could call it that at all, but in her definition of day, she says the objects of time and sense disappear in the illumination of spiritual understanding. And mind measures time according to the good that is unfolded. And in fact, she continues by quoting the Bible. She says this unfolding is God's day. And, quote from Revelation, there is no night there. So I guess it's not really time at all, is it? If it's a day with no night and it's the unfolding of good, it's not the human sense of time. So I don't know, maybe she doesn't say anything good about time. As we ponder our search for joy in seeing the sacred and in the mundane without a past or a future, it might be a helpful thing to think of toddlers. Even if you've never had one, you have probably watched how they pretty much are only devoted to the present. Take one for a walk sometime, and you will quickly see that they have no sense of trying to cover ground, get exercise, or reach a destination. It's all about the process. They will stop and look at something as intriguing as a cigarette butt, a dead leaf, or a bug. And you won't get them moving again until they're good and done checking it out. I can tell you that there is an amazing beauty to slowing down enough to enjoy the bubbles traveling under a thin layer of ice on a sloping parking lot. But as the parent of five toddlers at one time or another and the grandparent of one, it can also be really boring. And that is a suggestion, I think, that can creep into any caretaker's responsibility. So what does this have to do with a life that is so joyful that you can't help bursting out in song? Well, while a toddler may be happy or sad or even explosively so, a mature willingness on our part to consistently look for and perceive the beauty around us will lift away the gloom, boredom, or burden of caring for others, be they toddlers or adults. In attempting to get a painting job done some years ago, I unwisely left my 2.5-year-old and my 4-year-old to their own devices for a time. I was working. I had to get it done. And when I went to check on them, when they got quiet, which is always a really bad sign with little boys, I found the 4-year-old laying on the computer desk in one of our rooms, and he was guiding the 2.5-year-old on just how beautifully to scribble with a Sharpie marker on the wall under the table. So I took the marker and explained that we don't draw on walls, and, well, obviously we do, but we should not draw on walls. And asked them if they could just be good for a little bit longer. I was almost done. Ha ha. Went back, tried to finish the job before the paint dried on the ruler, and came back a little while later to find that they'd taken a 5-pound bag of sugar, poured it on the rug and the easy chair next to it, and were laying in it and doing like snow angels kind of thing. And the only reason I tell you this story, other than it is funny, they did this with ashes in the fireplace twice. So let me tell you, that is messy. But the real reason behind this is that I know all of you at one time or another have experienced that feeling of, I just have to get this job done, right? And we plow ahead with all the human will in the world. And of course, I finished the painting, and it was hideous. It was this, it looked like the basement of an old elementary school. It was like, it was so awful. And I thought, this is what I get for plowing ahead. I, with all my artistic spirit, I just felt crushed. And I thought, okay, I just really got to back up and take this more, you know, get a better sense of not trying to be busy with this, but that what's the joy? And I really had wanted this bedroom to be pretty for my girls, and it definitely wasn't. So I loaded the boys in the car, and everybody else was out of town at the time. So it was almost dinner time for little boys. We headed into town to pick up some things at Target that I needed for painting and to go to Lowe's to get the paint, which were real close to each other. So we went into Target, and I was like, oh, they really need food. So I bought them some Lunchables, and they were riding around in the buggy eating their food, and an absolute crazy thunderstorm came. Like, you could almost not hear anything in this giant Target because the rain was hitting the roof so hard, and the electricity went out. Well, I couldn't leave because my kids were already eating the food, so I couldn't just walk out of the store because they can't run. They wouldn't even take cash. They had to have those machines up so that they could take my money. So we wandered around Target for about an hour until the electricity came back on, and then I paid and went to Lowe's, covered the kids in the buggy with a plastic tablecloth because that was a lot cheaper than an umbrella. And we got to Lowe's, and I'm continuing this process of thinking about the joy behind what we're doing. And I got all this great paint and got a new idea, and I was very excited. Put the kids in the car, got back to our driveway, and we live on a 3/4-mile dirt road with a little creek through it that most of the time it's dry and occasionally has a couple inches of water, nothing serious. Well, we had fat flash floods. I couldn't drive through the creek, so our driveway is 3/4 mile long, and I parked at the end, grabbed what paint I could carry, and took these kids out, and I thought, I was almost in tears by this time. I thought, oh, this is going to be the hardest walk for these guys. It's past their bedtime. I've really made a mistake. And so we wade through this field to get around the creek and climb through the barbed wire and head down this driveway. Well, let me tell you, they jumped in every single puddle on that driveway as they went home, and they were laughing and having so much fun. And we got home, and I put them in a tub and put them to bed, and they just were just so joyful. And it was such a lesson to me. You know, that's the long story, but I'm sorry. But it was such a lesson to me about taking that joy to the task. And of course, the room came out really fun. It's still there in these colors today, and I ended up painting flowers on the walls and clouds on the ceiling, and it's a lot of fun. And the girls hardly ever lived in it. The boys pretty much took it over. But at any rate, just that idea of not getting focused with that human will sense of busyness. Now I have to find where I am. Okay. So that sense of accomplishment, right? What's our goal, right? And focusing more on the process than the goal. So, big segue here. Not really a good one, but I suspect that King David was a man of some spiritual consciousness. His life bears the marks of deep faith. And I wonder if his early parts, the early accounts of King David, were built on a lot of stillness and perhaps boredom that he endured as a shepherd. Because I suspect sheep herding is lots and lots of still time punctuated by high alert. And at least that's the way he seemed to describe it when he talked about killing the bear and the lion and the wolf and so on. But as a warrior and a king, we're given some really poignant examples of how the responsibilities and cares of this big job could at times overwhelm this peaceful, still judgment. It overwhelmed it with righteous anger. If you recall in the story where he went to kill Nabal and Nabal's wife Abigail stopped him. And his willful desire when he stole another man's wife and had that man killed. And his psalms perfectly portray this broad palette of thought with song coming to him in the night, night being, of course, symbolic of our darkest moments of thought. The Lord, he says, will command his loving kindness in the daytime and in the night. His song shall be with me and my prayer unto the God of my life. And on a more cheerful note, enter into his gates with thanksgiving and into his courts with praise. And I would submit to you that that's the only way that we can enter into his gates. I will say that I think we're about to sing a really beautiful Scottish tune. And one of my favorite things about it, other than that beautiful tune, is almost every verse starts with, I will come before the Lord, and what you'll do. So this hymn is number 506, I think, and it is in a handout for you. And Matthew and I will sing the first verse and just get it in your ear. And then I'd love it if you all would sing 2 through 5 with us.
I like that segment. Oh, okay. Yeah.
You can start. Is that okay? Y'all ready?
I will come before the Lord in the stillness of the morning, when golden dawn shines on the earth and I feel love's tender presence. You are my morning song.
Gorgeous tune. I found that one and I was like, oh, that's so beautiful. So here's where I want to kind of share some thoughts on how we get derailed and fooled into focusing on a false mortal consciousness. To illustrate, let's look at the story of the Tower of Babel from Genesis 11. There's a desire there. It's to build something that will make them, as it says, a name for ourselves. It would have its, quote, top in the heavens. I always kind of wondered why God broke up this little party and made them all speak different languages. I mean, wasn't there some unity there? But look at what they're doing. They were trying to build something that would represent the greatness of matter, of material accomplishment. It was meant to be really in competition with God, I think, and it was certainly a human accomplishment. By contrast, on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, we have men gathering to worship God. And while they speak in their own languages, they're still understood, aren't they? There can be no barrier to communication and success when the motive is spiritual. This passage from Proverbs in the New Revised Standard Version, I think you'll recognize it. I just thought it had a lovely sort of twist on the regular one we read in King James. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. Human accomplishment can hide behind the robes of sanctity or holiness, or things like, we have to make a living, we have to have an orderly home, be a good parent, paint a room, so on. But to do these things and be joyfully and fully conscious, we have only the goal of worship and praise. We have to have only that goal for love or God. Supporting a family is a wonderful thing to do. Obviously, order, cleanliness, and being a good parent are essential, but too often our desires to do those things are buried in burden of daily work that is not leavened by spiritual consciousness. They are tainted by ego and human will. I have to get this done. It is up to me to provide. Everything has to happen in this time frame or with this result, or you can fill in the blank. Here are just a couple of things, and there are many, that Mrs. Eddy says about human will. Human will belongs to the so-called material senses, and its use is to be condemned. She further states that human will is not Christian Science, and she says we must recognize it in order to defend ourselves against it. Human will is based on an ego separate from God. There is only one I, the great I am that Moses spoke, that spoke to Moses at the burning bush. We can relinquish this false sense of ego or desire to accomplish by staying in the present. We can go back to that. By simply being present and not looking to the future. And I know you all know this, but there is never enough accomplishment humanly to keep us satisfied. Think of the last line of Mary Baker Eddy's poem, Satisfied, where she says, who doth his will, his likeness still, is satisfied. And look at that. She even uses the word, his likeness still. It's that stillness, isn't it? I was so excited when I saw that. When we actively pursue his will for us, this brings the true satisfaction that we all crave. In Psalms, it says, as for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness. Don't you love that it says awake with God's likeness? It's truly a matter of waking up to the truth of our likeness to God. It's not making ourselves into that likeness. There's a real quietness about this kind of awakened consciousness. I think it's present in all truly spiritual thought. It's reflected universally in quality care, just as it's given at Olive Glen. And it doesn't necessarily even have to say words, in order for it to be felt, that reflected love. We saw it in that biblical example of Elijah, didn't we? And what he witnessed, the power of that stillness. I had the great privilege of witnessing the power of that kind of silent affirmation of consciousness and awareness a little over a year ago when I went up to Fairbanks to be with my dad as he was making the transition and passing. He was staying in a lovely facility. It was not a Christian Science facility, but the nursing there was just absolutely amazing. It brought me to tears on multiple occasions. But this one instance was one that I know will just go with me forever. The illness that seemed to be troubling my dad made it so that he couldn't communicate. He couldn't write easily, and he couldn't speak, but he still knew everything that was going on, and so he had things he wanted to say and found it very frustrating when he couldn't communicate his needs. So I'm there visiting, and he starts to get very agitated and trying to tell me something, and as a good daughter, I'm standing there with a pen and with pictures and trying to figure out what he wants, and I was getting just completely worked up trying to understand, and he was getting frustrated and throwing things off the tray with his arm, and I finally just pushed the little button to call the nurse because I thought, well, maybe they've been with him for a while, maybe they'll know. Well, what happened was earth-shaking for me. This lovely nurse came in, and I told her, oh, he needs something. I don't know what he needs. You know, obviously I was all agitated. And she didn't say anything, didn't say a single word. She walked up to him and put one hand on each of his shoulders and looked in his eyes. And she stood there. And a minute went by, a full minute, dead silence. And I'm sitting on the bed next to his easy chair. And by this time, I'm starting to weep. It was just a palpable feeling. 2 minutes goes by. 3 minutes. I swear to you, it was forever. And she just stood there and stared into his eyes. And he just began to relax and stopped whatever it was that he needed to say. And I realized, oh my gosh, here I am working in the practice of Christian Science Healing, and I just so missed the boat here. He didn't need anything. He needed to be seen. He needed to feel love. I mean, he did. He needed that. But he didn't need a thing or a whatever it was. I don't even know. And everything was met in her seeing him. And the love that she felt for him was just, it was just amazing. I know I can't put it in words. It was just so beautiful. But I feel like that is what all nurses have to give, and it's just a gift beyond value. It's a beautiful lesson of the universality of this passage from Science and Health. Undisturbed, amid the jarring testimony of the material senses, science, still enthroned, is unfolding to mortals the immutable, harmonious, divine principle, is unfolding life and the universe, ever present and eternal. It's important to note that this quality of calm, conscious contentment is not openly valued by society. We therefore need to be a bit zealous in our defense of it in our lives, at least popularly. We pay homage to the extra busy, the overworked, the underslept, in short, the abused, as the model of virtue. I know this. I grew up with a highly valued New England work ethic. We were taught that we should be satisfied and happy and praised according to our hard work, whatever its cost or whatever it produced. But joy is definitely not found in this harried and false sense of accomplishment, as we inevitably find. I love in Mrs. Eddy's definition of time, which I'm coming back to here, it seems to sum up everything about human accomplishment. In the middle of it, she says, time is limits in which are summed up all human acts. Another word for busyness or lack of conscious awareness is the subconscious. In a popular experiment from the 90s, which some of you may be familiar with, it was done by Christopher Chabris and Daniel Simons. They took people at Harvard University and showed them a video. They asked them each to watch a video. It was about a minute and a half long. You can find it online if you want. It's pretty funny. And they have a group of people in white t-shirts, maybe like four or five in white and four or five in darker t-shirts. And they're passing, tossing a basketball around on a small, in a small space, like on a court, but in a smaller area. And you are told to, your job as a viewer is to count the number of basketballs thrown by the people that are wearing white t-shirts. In the middle of the video, a person in a gorilla suit walks through the court, pounds its chest, and walks off the court, and it takes about 9 seconds. It just is a casual stroll. It's not like they're racing in and out. And 50% of viewers missed the gorilla. And I tried this with my 12-year-old, who is like the most observant kid I think I've ever met. And I said, hey, watch this video and tell me how many times the people in the white shirt throw the basketball. And he said, at the end, he says, 16 times. And I said, did you see the gorilla? No. There was a gorilla? And he says, wait. And, you know, he rewinds and he goes, how did I miss that? So it is a real thing. It is a real thing. It's super funny. I mean, now that you know, of course you'll see the gorilla, but you can try it on some unsuspecting family member if you want. So I don't want to, you know, it's a great metaphor for how we miss so many things because we're focused on our busyness. And I wouldn't want to say that the gorilla is representative of the things of God. But perhaps we can at least admit that we are counting metaphorical ball passes or human steps to success, and we might miss the larger spiritual picture. Spiritual consciousness can reveal the presence of good right where lack or evil might seem to be, and we have to be aware and awake to see the good. But that good is underlying all reality. And as we practice this skill of calm and quiet spiritual consciousness, we find the invisible becoming visible. As we know, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. For those of you who read the Cedars Mets that I write, this story might be familiar, and I'll try to be real brief with it. But a really great example that sticks in my thought regularly of how these invisible things become visible to us and really tangible happened to me some years ago. I was really needing a quiet, separate space from my family to do my practice in. And we have a small house and six of us living in it and no extra rooms. And we didn't have the money to build something. And I felt like I couldn't rent a place somewhere because I have my mom living with us and she has some needs and two boys are homeschooled. So I felt like I needed to be kind of on hand, but still needed a place. And I was just cherishing this. And long story short is after over many months, I wasn't agitated about it. I was just, every time it came to my thought, you know, I entertained sort of spiritual ideas about it. And all of a sudden, I looked and saw this little shed that we had on our property that we'd been given and picked up and brought to our property many, many years before. And probably 5 or 6 years before that, we had backed it up to our garage. So this was not hidden. This was right there. And we'd hooked it up to electricity. And so I had, you know, I could put in a space heater or air conditioning unit that we also had sitting in the garage. And all it had was junk in it. And I cleaned it out and washed the windows. It didn't even take a day to get it ready. It's about 8 by 8 feet, and it has windows on all sides. And there was my office. And you have to come out of the house, walk around the garage, which is separate, and into my office. So it had that barrier that I needed so that the kids didn't just barge in whenever they wanted. They had to really make a careful thought about it. This kind of consciousness meets our human needs, right? I needed a place where I could do my work more conscientiously. And all I had to do was stop counting those basketballs, and there it was. The office just appeared, and I'm still enjoying it every day and give gratitude every day I sit down in there. Another verse, or part of a verse from Mrs. Eddy's poem, Satisfied, really just so beautifully applicable here. It matters not what be thy lot, so loved a guide. For storm or shine, pure peace is thine. What e'er betide. So I really am coming to a close here soon. In our discussion of this joy in our sacred work, we see that spiritual consciousness is paramount. Within that consciousness, it's helpful to have some stillness, not a false sense of busyness, right? We need to recognize only one ego, and that's God. And we need to live in the present. Mary Baker Eddy has a poem, which you are all well familiar with, that addresses this kind of spiritual consciousness. And I'm going to read it and say a few words. And then Matthew and I are going to sing a musical setting of it that he came up with for just this special occasion. It's Christ My Refuge. O'er waiting harp strings of the mind, there sweeps a strain. Lo, sad and sweet, whose measures bind the power of pain? And wake a white-winged angel throng of thoughts, illumined by faith and breathed in raptured song with love perfumed. Then his unveiled sweet mercies show life's burdens light. I kiss the cross and wake to know a world more bright. And o'er earth's troubled, angry sea, I see Christ walk and come to me and tenderly, divinely talk. Thus truth engrounds me on the rock upon life's shore, against which the winds and waves can shock, oh, nevermore. From tired joy and grief afar and nearer thee, Father, where thine own children are, I love to be. My prayer, some daily good to do to thine for thee, an offering pure of love, whereto God leadeth me. In this amazing poem, she speaks of that stillness as waiting. We need to wait for spirit to move on those harp strings, right? She tells of that power of listening, the consciousness that we get that has the power to bind pain, and of the inspired joy that comes in the form of a throng of angel thoughts, not just one. This consciousness, she tells us, makes our burdens light. Of course, one of the essential elements of a joyful, sacred approach to life is our ability to welcome challenges as the opportunity that they are to kiss the cross. And then she tells us we wake to know a world more bright, become even more spiritually aware, right? Matter or earth will appear troubled and angry. But with this spiritual consciousness, we get to see Christ walk to us and talk, speak to us, and we can hear him. And of course, the whole point of sacred work that makes us sing is that we do it for others. When our motives in whatever work we do is out of love for God, to serve, bless, and heal, well, we cannot help but have a life filled with song.